It's the Burt Cohen Show. And history shows that in America, the last 100 years or so, actually more like 60 years, when people hear the word socialism or communism, their mind shuts down. They don't want to listen. They don't want to hear. But what the heck is socialism? What is communism? Does anybody really have any idea? They're the bad guys, obviously. We're the good guys. That's all you need to know, right? Well, it's thinking like that that got us into completely unnecessary and horrible wars like Vietnam by defining this country, which was striving for its national identity and independence, putting it in the Cold War context, which didn't fit, caused 58,000 Americans to die, who knows how many to lose limbs, and who knows how many Vietnamese and Cambodians in the oceans. So what is communism? Our guest today, and what is capitalism for that matter, is it's this wonderful system that works so well, so fairly for everybody, and there's no violence involved. Our guest today is Jesse Meyerson, columnist for Salon. Thanks so much for being with us, Jesse.
It's my pleasure to be on. Thanks for having me, Bert.
Well, Jesse, you just wrote an article titled, Why You're Wrong About Communism, Seven Huge Misconceptions About It and Capitalism. Most of what Americans think they know about capitalism and communism, of course, is total nonsense. First, let me ask this. Has there ever been an actual communist state? Does the Paris Commune count? Has there been a real communist state, or are there just a whole bunch of nasty systems masquerading as communist?
Well, it's sort of a complicated question that, I mean, obviously none of the formerly communist states that we've seen in the world, from the Soviet Union to Mao's China, is the sort of ideal that most American communists would look for, who talk about, you know, freedom and equality and freedom from repression and stuff like that. But these were societies that attempted to make revolution and build communism. And, you know, we can analyze what went wrong and why they failed to do that, why they didn't reach the sort of beautiful ideal of full equality. But in the United States, because of the Cold War, we're never encouraged to actually analyze what went wrong, how it went wrong. We're simply encouraged to think that the communist project altogether is evil, and it's necessarily, will result, unlike capitalism, will result in this sort of death and carnage. And that, of course, is a complete fallacy, and actually I think does tremendous disrespect to the victims of those regimes to simply chalk their deaths up to some sort of abstract notion of communism rather than actually looking at the details of history.
And certainly when I was growing up in the 50s, and yes, I am that old, the Russians were clearly the bad guys. There was tremendous amount of fear. There was hiding under the desks. There was this. I mean, it seems to me that in the 50s, the Red Scare was the introduction to the very notion of communism for millions of us, baby boomers. Anyway, aside from, all of us kind of preferring not to be nuked by the Ruskies, what was the point of the Red Scare? What was the effect of it on political discourse in America, on traditional patriotic American liberals and lefties? And, you know, there is a strong, the right wing likes to invent their own version of history, but there's a long tradition of an American left. So two questions. What was the point of the Red Scare, and what was its effect on political discourse domestically?
Well, I would say that the purpose of the Red Scare, in hindsight, now sort of looking at it from the remove of this many years, and of course, I, as somebody who have come of political age after the Soviet Union's lapse and sort of isn't encumbered by the sort of residue of that Cold War fear, it really looks to me, and I think we can see this in current or, I guess, recently bygone tensions between the Putin and Obama administrations, the Cold War really begins to look like a kind of an imperial conflict between two massive industrial empires, Russia on the one hand and the United States on the other hand, that sort of played itself out in, or rather cloaked itself in, ideological terms. This was about communism or capitalism, but it really just seems like it was, these two major countries that still have conflict, that of course had conflicts before, geopolitical tensions before the revolution of 1917. And it was sort of papered over in ideological terms, and that this served a couple of useful purposes. For one thing, it helped the capitalist ownership class of the United States extend its influence throughout the world under the banner of sort of doing right and doing good and being a liberatory force in the world, while, of course, it slaughtered and, imprisoned millions of people in various continents. And the other thing it did was allowed the U.S. government to dismantle the U.S. left, which before the second wave of the Red Scare in the 1940s really looked like it was gaining steam. I mean, the depression led to an enormous amount of disaffection with capitalism and lots of militancy among labor, and then that all came to the head when, in 1947, Taft-Hartley passed, which kicked communists out of the labor movement, ended Operation Dixie, which was seeking to unionize workers in the South along racially integrated lines, setting back the movement for civil rights in the South and the end of Jim Crow by 15, 20 years, dismantling large numbers of sort of left movements with communist leaders, putting communist leaders in jail, and basically instituting a massive chilling effect on the U.S. left, so that what we had coming out of the McCarthy era was a sort of unmoored, defanged, weak sort of liberalism that has, of course, led to the sort of neoliberal kind of Reaganite situation that we have now of just simply corporate crony, the neoliberal thing of reducing transfers to poor people and putting the well-connected in charge of projects. And that's what you get when you don't have a strong left resisting that tendency, and the Cold War really enabled the capitalist class to put that left down in the U.S.
Very interesting. A lot to talk about there. Our guest today on the Bert Cohen Show is Jesse Meyerson, columnist for Salon.com. And there have been Red Scares in the past, clearly, and it's been used to repress American dissidents. And during, 2014 is the 100th anniversary of that horrible tragedy, avoidable tragedy called the Great War, now known as the First World War. And dissidents were rounded up under the Alien and Sedition Act. And it was very, very effective at chilling dissidents, people who opposed America's entry into that war, which, quite frankly, we should not have entered. But that's another story. And in the 30s, you point out there's a very strong case that there was the Depression and there was a lot of communist activism, American communists. It wasn't such a dirty word in the 1930s. And some of the bravest, most idealistic Americans then volunteered to fight in Spain. There were a lot of them were communists, and they went to fight the fascists in Spain, who were backed by Hitler and Mussolini. And had the U.S. supported the Republic in Spain against the fascists, who knows? Maybe Hitler would have gotten the word that, oh, the U.S. really is a force to be reckoned with. I digress. People who know me know history. I love history. But one of your main points is that, quote, only communist economies rely on state violence. And you say further that many people believe that communism killed 110 million people Now, of course, there's no way to verify that number. And another point is that the belief that capitalist governments don't commit human rights violations and atrocities. Do you have any reason to think that significant numbers of Americans actually believe this?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the sort of hate reactions that I routinely get on the internet to when I propose a pretty far left economic project that's mine really shows that everyone is perfectly happy to take the atrocities committed under, say, Pol Pot and Mao and Stalin and say that these were the fault of communism, but then take the atrocities committed under capitalist regimes like the transatlantic slave trade and the starving out of, perhaps 100 million Indian people under British colonial rule and all of these sorts of things, the genocide against the indigenous population of this continent, and chalk them up to things other than capitalism. So it's just this sort of ridiculous double standard that comes out of the sloppy thinking fostered by the Cold War that says that communism is necessarily a violent system and that capitalism is necessarily, or like at least at its core, based on free markets, free exchange, and peaceful democracy between people. And of course, these are completely mythological, totally wrong, and don't stand up to any sort of scrutiny at all. I mean, the simple fact of the fact, capitalism is based on and really fosters ruthless competition among people. It means that in order to counteract the, this is a little Marxist here, so other people's mileage may vary, but in order to counteract the tendency of the rate of profit to fall, it means that capitalists have to constantly search for other markets, and often this means conquering other territories and expanding into, other people's realms and have, basically bringing ruthless competition everywhere. And it would seem natural to imagine that might result in great violence, and yet people somehow can't see it, even though the evidence for it is so great. Ireland, during the potato famine, right, where millions of people were starving to death, was still a net exporter of potatoes because Britain was simply taking it from them for its own capitalist purposes. The Industrial Revolution, that greatest moment in all of capitalist expansion, was fueled by one item and one commodity in particular, and that was textiles. And where did the cotton from that come from?
Uh-huh.
It came from the United States, where it was being farmed by slaves. So all of these horrendous episodes in human rights atrocities that were perpetuated in order to advance somebody's profit agenda, those are not chalked up to capitalism. They're chalked up to any number of things. Whereas something like, what Stalin did in the Ukraine or the gulags or something like that, this is taken as being part and parcel of communism rather than being attributable to specific historical circumstances. And it's just wrong, and it doesn't make any sense to continue these lies in an age beyond the Soviet Union after the lapse of formal communism, when we really have some leeway and a situation where capitalism has really failed us, and we now really have some leeway to think about alternatives. It doesn't make sense to simply use communism as a stand-in for all that's evil and bad in the world.
And I don't think anybody would argue that Stalin was a nice guy, a good guy. He was not. And as you point out, and as I had a history professor way back in college who said that World War II was a struggle between four imperial powers, Germany, Britain, America, and the Soviet Union. And then after the war, there was two huge imperial powers rushing to destroy Germany and to get to Berlin first. And it's pretty well known fact that Truman used the atomic bomb on the 100,000 or so people that were killed in Nagasaki and Hiroshima, not to squash the Japanese, but as part of the first phase of the war against Stalin. And to call Stalin a communist is just, he was a bad guy and a dictator. Even Hitler called himself a nationalist socialist. I mean, it was just a cover. He was certainly a nationalist, but it was a cover. And getting back a little bit to the Red Scare, and it's a subject you talked about again there, about how it's good for business. Let's face it, it's really good for business to have an enemy that we need to constantly be building these incredible weapon systems on. The Red Scare was very, very useful. And of course, now that there's no Red Scare, we have the terrorist scare. You could just substitute the word for terrorist, which is really a method, really. Like, you know, belief in communism is a belief in an ideal, but terrorism is a method of fighting war. Where am I going with this? I'm not sure, but I hope it's entertaining. Now, I had a professor back in college, Daryl Baskin, may he rest in peace, who defined politics as the economy of violence. Look at the history of the 20th century. There was a tremendous amount of state violence here in America against veterans of the First World War, for example, when troops fought veterans. Tremendous amount of violence against workers demanding their rights to organize. A lot of violence against protesters. Oh, 4 people were killed at Kent State, students. I mean, you know, violence, it seems, is just built into this thing on both sides. I wonder if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, it's the entire, the conceit of a nation state is that the government has a monopoly on violence and will yield it to, or will not yield it, will wield that monopoly on violence in order to advance its interests. And so you had in the Soviet Union a situation where they found themselves locked in this inter-imperial struggle with the United States of America,
yes,
but
yes.
Also found themselves in a situation where basically, as of the end of the Tsarist age, they were a primarily agricultural, essentially feudal, non-industrialized society in
right.
a competition with the most advanced capitalist industrialist society in the world. As the British Empire was crumbling under the weight of national resistance movements around the world, and so they had to, if they wanted to compete, they had to really speed up the pace of industrialization. And the same is true with China. And,
sure.
and industrialization really requires a lot of ruthless, horrible human rights atrocities. It did in the United States, obviously, as I mentioned, with the extermination of the indigenous population and the slave society of the South. But so it also required that there. It required slave labor in the Soviet Union through the gulags in order to industrialize. It yielded the absolutely horrible Great Chinese Famine, terrible applied pseudoscience and stat juking and cronyism and really, if we want to look at the violence that that sort of marked the 20th century communist regimes, I think we have to attribute a lot of it to war and to industrialization, and neither of those is an especially communist phenomenon. Those are obviously part and parcel of the capitalist system and of capitalism over the last 200 years. And so you have a situation where in those countries, and we see this now in China, which is still a formally communist country. I mean, the Communist Party is the one party in control, although it would be very difficult for anyone to make the case that their system resembles anything like communism.
Absolutely.
It's merely a capitalist system.
Oh,
it fuels the capitalist production economy that meets the West's consumption needs. And so what you have is basically, and had in the Soviet Union, is basically a capitalist society where workers are being exploited for their excess labor power, which is being sucked up by the ownership class. It just so happens that the ownership class in these countries, weirdly, is the Communist Party. So setting aside that model, which I think is no longer valid now that these countries are industrialized and don't have to go through an industrial revolution, I think that we can sort of look at ways of reorganizing our political economies to foster that sort of communal ownership of capital and wealth, and therefore the abolition of poverty and the achievement of universal material security and a really inspiring degree of equality without having to look at things like the gulags and the Great Chinese Famine, which could not happen again because they don't have to reindustrialize.
Wow, very, very good points there. And you reminded me of it was no just accident that Mao came up with, excuse me, with the phrase, the description, the Great Leap Forward, because, as you mentioned, both the Soviet Union and China started off like at least 100 years in terms of economic industrialization behind the United States. They had to move fast, and the decisions were being made by a centralized political structure, which is not necessarily communist at all. It's just kind of dictatorial. And, you know, history shows that at least two of the baddest bad guys, Stalin and Mao, and many other allegedly communist dictators, employed great state violence. Who were their victims? Were they people fighting against communism that they killed?
Well, there certainly was that. I mean, to look at the first 30 years of the Soviet Union, right, it's born in the midst of war, in the midst of the First World War, which you brought up earlier, and Lenin actually takes them out of the war, saying that this is a war of empires, and we're not trying to be an empire, we're trying to build communism.
Sure.
So it starts in the middle of war, right, unlike the United States, say. And then from that, it lapses into a civil war that has tons of foreign fighters, including from the United States, sending troops against the Red Army. And as soon as that's over, they have the fascist Germans, not an ocean away like in the United States, but actually making incursions into Russian territory. And so they fight that war. And so that basically prescribes the first 30 years of Soviet history. And in that time, they're also, as I say, trying to industrialize. And this sort of naturally, or perhaps not naturally, but I think that is a much better explainer of the sort of the violence that, Stalin and others carried out than simply to say that there's a communist dream involved. But the other thing to note is that not just the reactionaries, right, the Gulags and people who were resisting, land reforms and other attempts at communalizing wealth, but actually communists. I mean, Stalin's Great Purge was purging other Bolshevik revolutionaries. You know, he killed Trotsky after all, and actually on a number of occasions recalled and executed entire communist parties in Eastern Europe, which made it much easier for the fascists, for the Germans to take over. You know, in France, the basis of the anti-Nazi resistance in France were communists. And what was found in Eastern Europe was that resistance didn't exist because Stalin had killed off all of the communists who would have made up the resistance to fascism. And so you have a situation where in the United States, the mythology has developed that the 110 million or whatever number people like to cite, and it's never scientific, that were slaughtered in by these formerly communist regimes in the 20th century were slaughtered because they were resisting communists, because nobody in their right mind, this Fox News host who was talking about me said 110 million were slaughtered because nobody in their right mind would sign up for a left-wing dream. And that's simply just not the case. I mean, lots of these people were thoroughly signed up for the communist, the left-wing dream, and were killed by Stalin for reasons other than simple ideological matters. You know, I mean, their power politics that that are fraught in every part of the ideological spectrum. So that's sort of, I think, what people should note about Stalin's crimes, is that they weren't indiscriminate. It wasn't like he went out and killed a bunch of capitalists. He killed tons of communists. Too. The purpose was to retain his power as and to advance what he considered the communist project in Russia, and that took a lot of lives, and it sure turned off a huge swath of the global left to official communism. Mm. You know, there are all these anti-Stalinist socialist sects that would never endorse something like what Stalin was doing in the Great Purge and in various other terrible human rights atrocities.
Yeah, it does seem like Stalin was a very, very good organizer against Stalinism. If you just tuned in, our guest today is Jesse Meyerson, columnist for Salon.com. We're talking about what's communism, what's capitalism, huge misunderstanding. And you have a list of significant points And one of them is that the claim that capitalist economies are based on free exchange. Did free exchange begin with capitalism, or was it there before somehow? I mean, would there not be free exchange, which we kind of like, without capitalism?
Of course there would be. There were enormous markets. Markets predate capitalism by millennia. I mean, the great trading empires of, you know, the Netherlands with the, you know, or Venice, where modern science begins, this all predates capitalism. I mean, Venice became a trading empire really during the Fourth Crusade and, you know, round about the turn of the 15th century. And capitalism didn't come along until the end of the 18th, or middle to end of the 18th century. So obviously they're not one and the same. And of course, under capitalism, the entire structure for guaranteeing property rights and contract law and all of these things that, capitalist exchange and capitalist production and capitalist distribution really depend on are guaranteed by the government wielding state power, coercive power, and excluding all but one claimant to a piece of property. And if that makes for free exchange, then we have different understandings of what freedom and exchange are, really. But really what determines who gets the resources in capitalism isn't so much a bunch of people coming together freely into a marketplace to exchange and find the most efficient distribution of resources, it's who has the most bargaining power at that exchange. And the people who have the most bargaining power are the people who own the most capital. And when I say own the most capital, meaning like exert the greatest number of claims to land, stocks, bonds, things with titles and deeds and mortgages, you know, that's what I mean by property, not like a necklace or a phone or something like that, just a possession. I mean like something like a financial asset that people hold. When I say that people have the most of that, it's not that they actually have it, or they like can't clutch it in their arms.
Right.
It's simply that they own a piece of paper that entitles them to it, and the thing that makes it so that nobody else can hold that piece of paper and own it is the government being willing to devote its violent, coercive power, its monopoly on violence, to defending the right of that person to own it. So if that's free exchange, you know, then, you know, as I say, we have different understandings of what those words mean. But basically, it's taken by everyone to be natural that wealth and that those capital assets should accumulate in the hands of a tiny, small number of people, and that everybody else should basically be propertyless and consigned to working for a living, to try to survive, to get their basic needs met by working harder and harder for a boss that's trying to exploit them more and more in order to get richer and richer. And there's just nothing natural about it. It doesn't foster free exchange. Markets predate capitalism, and they will survive capitalism. If we move to a situation of communal ownership where everyone takes part in the national enterprise, everyone reaps the fruits of our social production rather than just a tiny number of capitalists, there will still be markets. People will still go out to exchange what they have for other things. There will still be money. Those things, there will be no, in other words, great leap forward from capitalism. But I do think it's time that we take a decisive step forward from capitalism and liberate a huge number of peoples. Specifically, what I think we need to do is make it so that people are not dependent on work for their basic means of survival. I think we need to move to a situation where people have their basic means of survival guaranteed by the government as a basic human right.
Wow, a lot of people, frankly, would find what you just said quite objectionable. A nation of, you know, having a nanny state, having the state take care of things, doing away with people's, you know, entrepreneurial spirit, people's need to get ahead, and people would find, you know, a hard time with that. That, I mean, people would, I think, say, you know, why work hard to be a surgeon, for example, when you can receive the same remuneration for working as a fry cook or having an easy job or having no job at all? What's the incentive there? Isn't that really the destruction of actual communism, not this totalitarian dictatorial stuff, but actual communism? Where's the incentive there?
Well, I have to say there are plenty of incentives that aren't simply money. I mean, most people, the incentive structure that we talk about when we talk about capitalist incentives, the incentive structure for a very, very tiny, slim minority of the ownership class is getting fabulously wealthy. That's the incentive. Whereas the incentive for the vast majority of people who live with modest to actually quite meager means is simply avoiding starvation and privation. And that's a really inhumane system of incentive.
Yeah.
Whereas if everybody knew that their material security were guaranteed, that they could simply have, they knew that they had access to healthcare, education, shelter, food, community, and culture, then we could have a whole number of more elegant and humane incentives. Like for instance, if you think about the somebody who codes, who writes code, or somebody who plays guitar, or somebody who goes out to become a doctor. Normally, these are not motivated by the desire to get rich. Normally, they're motivated by other things. You know, the guitarist wants the standing ovation, the coder wants to go viral, the doctor wants to heal people. And so we see that in, for instance, Cuba, where you cannot get rich by being a doctor, still a great number of people go into that field. And actually, Cuba exports doctors to impoverished places all over the globe and provides some of the highest quality health care in the world.
That is true.
And that incentive structure does not include getting fabulously wealthy. So I think that there are other ways to incentivize what we want as a society. Like, let's say what we need is grunt work done, right? Somebody to go out and do that hard job, right?
Right.
Like go and pick up trash or something like that. The way to do that is to simply pay them a bunch of money to do that. But at the moment, that's not what happens. At the moment, that's disincentivized by getting a meager wage, while really what's incentivized, if you want to get wealthy, is doing what Mitt Romney does or Donald Trump and investing in real estate and engaging in arbitrage and trying to juke the market and save points off of benign price changes. You know, this kind of thing is not productive. It's not hard work. It's not getting the work done that needs to get done. It's incentivizing rent seeking and extraction of money from the economy rather than being actually productive. So if everybody were materially secure and we found that there was something we needed done that nobody wanted to do because they were materially secure and didn't have to do it just in order to survive, we could create new incentives for that. They could be monetary. They could be based on public praise and ceremony and prizes. It could be based on any number of things. But to say that somehow the current incentive structure really generates, just or desirable outcomes is just to ignore the simple facts on the ground of our wealth and income distribution.
We are talking on the Bert Cohen Show today about people's misunderstandings of capitalism and communism, what it really is. Their guest is Jesse Meyerson, columnist for Salon. And you're talking about, as you describe, a few powerful families owning a huge percentage of what can be owned, the wealth of the nation, and a lot of people working for peanuts, basically, and the, you know, lords always looking to have, you know, fewer regulations, worse working conditions, less ability to organize, and lower wages. It sounds like feudalism that existed 1,000 years ago. I fail to see much of a difference, quite frankly.
We absolutely are in a neo-feudal age. I mean, I think that especially the lapse of the industrial economies of the West following globalization and basically the transshipment of industrial production to the poorest corners of the world, where basically the ownership things that people have in the United States and in parts of Western Europe are rent-seeking, not investing in new means of production and hiring new labor in order to expand the capital stock, but simply owning things like patents and deriving royalties from them, owning land and deriving rent from it, owning real estate and deriving capital gains from flipping it. And these kinds of things are really, I mean, all you have to do is look at the word landlord. You know, real estate is the most lucrative asset form in the United States.
Oh, yes.
And more than half of the value of real estate is not the actual physical structure itself, the plumbing, the woodwork.
No.
It's the land. It's the value of the land.
The property.
And so you have
the location, yeah.
And what could more precisely indicate a feudal relationship than somebody who is literally the lord of the land coming to the, you know, the peasant, the serf's door and knocking and demanding tribute simply for using the land that he or she, usually he, claims to own. And whose claim is backed up by, as I mentioned before, coercive government violence, which is, for some reason, we don't think of as like a governmental intrusion into the free market. And so it definitely, when you see the number of companies who the most of their stock price is buffered by their access to monopoly rents, patent royalties, rent stemming from their ownership of and the extraction of natural resources, it really does begin to look much more feudal than capitalist. In capitalism,
absolutely,
we would be taxing the hell out of the land and not taxing industry and labor, and therefore we would be incentivizing industry and labor and disincentivizing the sort of feudal land ownership rent extracting mode that we've really fallen into over the last 40 years in the United States. So I think your analysis is quite right, yeah.
Well, one thing, as people on this show have heard me say before, one thing I've learned from history is that we never learn from history. And you say that capitalists are compelled to support oppressive regimes and wreck the planet as a matter of business, end quote. Now, I remember Dick Gephardt, who was certainly no lefty, really, but a traditional Democrat, he used to talk about capitalism with a conscience. And, you know, in the 30s, when there was a lot of communist agitation, quite understandably, because it looked like the system was failing and a lot of people were suffering terribly, yeah, there was a concern about communism, and FDR had some programs to invest in infrastructure to create jobs, to build the public good, and frankly, it saved capitalism. Now, there are entities, capitalist entities, which do thrive with a conscience. I mean, there's obviously Ben and Jerry's. I understand Tesla Corporation now is not holding on to its patent. I mean, good for them. Is it an exaggeration to say that capitalism per se is compelled to support oppressive regimes and wreck the planet at a matter of business?
Well, it's. I would say that those corporations have a profit motive that they think will be well suited by fostering a public image of themselves as being conscientious. And perhaps the executives are, and perhaps the shareholders are. That's to take nothing away from them to say that they want to do business in a way that they find more humane and just. But in the end, the vast majority of the capital stock isn't owned by Ben and Jerry's, small companies like that. It's big corporations. And those corporations really are, I mean, so I was part of an activist group called US Uncut some years back, and we collaborated with the Yes Men, who do culture jamming. I don't know if your listeners are familiar with them. But we released a fake, I wasn't personally involved in this, but we, the group I was involved with, released a fake press release because it came out that year. This was the year of, I think it was 2011, when austerity was really, really hitting hard. And it came out that all of these corporations paid $0 in corporate income tax to the federal government and actually had gotten quite significant tax breaks. So GE, which was laying off workers left and right, actually made, I think, several billion dollars off of the government that year and paid $0 in corporate income tax. So we set out a fake press release to say that GE was going to be donating back the tax break it got because times were hard, and they wanted to, show that they had a conscience and be good patriotic citizens. And lo and behold, when that press release got picked up as real by news outlets, what happens? GE's stock price plummeted. People wanted to get rid of it. So you lose investors. The board gets upset whenever one of these big corporations does something for conscience. You know, you see these executives who would really love not to support an apartheid regime, for instance, or would really love not to destroy the, you know, rainforest in the Amazon, but the profit motive simply compels them to. If they don't do that, they will lose in the ruthless competition of the capitalist market. And they simply can't afford to do that. So the imperatives to compete, the imperatives to develop the forces of production, the imperatives to intensify the exploitation of labor, put a capitalist in a situation where being good and showing conscience can really make a whole business go belly up. And when times are tough, people will, if I can't remember the wit who remarked that it's very difficult to convince a man to do good when his job depends on not doing good. But that's, I think, the situation that most capitalists find themselves in, even ones of quite good conscience.
Yeah, and it and when it comes down to a crunch, absolutely, you're right. And a lot of my friends on the right, and I do have actually a lot of friends on the right, we like to involve, you know, engage in good, sometimes intelligent political discourse. Their big thing, of course, is freedom. And, you know, I'm a traditional American liberal lefty that I love freedom, too. You know, freedom is just, that's something that we kind of worship. And I wonder if you could talk a bit about the concept and reality of a free market, an alleged free market, and freedom. How, and you talked about this a little bit before, how free are we if we lack the resources to just live? And before you answer that, I thought it was interesting that you pointed out that there's a lot of the greatest artists oftentimes have been America. I mean, what could be more revealing, manifesting of freedom than being an artist? An artist is free. How is it that, I mean, talk a bit about the relationship between a free market and real freedom, if you would, please, Jesse.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is the crucial point. I think what libertarians get right is that a strong government with a big surveillance apparatus and all of the things that we've seen come to fruition, especially in the era since September 11th, that these are real threats to freedom. I think libertarians get that right. I think that they don't go far enough, where if they were even more libertarian, I mean that with a small L, like simply more motivated by positive human liberty, they would really say that the other major threat to freedom is the employer-employee relationship. You know, we live in this alleged democracy with freedom, and yet 8 hours a day or so is spent in what basically amounts to a tyranny, where a boss, for whatever reason he wants, can fire you and take away your means of surviving. And I think that it's underappreciated on the right what a threat to freedom that is. I mean, just imagine if not only were you free to say the things you want, or to worship the way you want, or to have your media site not infringed by the government, but actually if you were also free to pursue your passions because you didn't have to go out and work. You know, the person who, let's say the woman in New York City who has two children and no husband and has to go work two jobs in a row, and they're both fast food jobs, can we say that she's really free? Can we say that that situation for her has really fostered her freedom more than if she had some sort of guaranteed income, some sort of guaranteed health care, and found herself then able to spend more time with her kids, to go out and learn a language, to develop an artistic practice that she likes, to develop a spiritual practice, to actually go out and worship, to actually go out and make free speech? I really think that that's underappreciated on the right, the extent to which material security for everyone would truly foster quite significant freedom, and it's reasonably clear that the only way to get material security for everyone is to collectively own the wealth of the society.
Yeah, it's interesting to me as I look back on the image I've always gotten of communism under Stalin and then Khrushchev and then the guys after that, was state ownership and control of everything that got produced. There was no competition, among products. People couldn't be, I mean, and that's another issue, you know, maybe I hope we can talk about, is the difference between being a citizen and being a consumer. Many people don't see any difference, I think, just being a consumer. There was, you know, they owned everything. They and nowadays, I note that, in fact, just recently it came out that Walmart is the biggest, most powerful, most wealthy business in the world. It's an essentially a monopoly. There is virtually no competition. How free is the exchange, I wonder, if one entity owns the market. And sometimes I allow myself to be, to fantasize that what if, you know, since there virtually are no other department stores, there's just Walmart, why not make that work for the public good? Well, you know, how free is the exchange if one entity owns the whole market? That was a big problem with communism. You know, Moscow dominated, and we seem to have moved kind of in that direction.
Absolutely. I mean, the tendency under capitalism unquestionably is to accumulate all wealth under a single trust. I mean, the mergers and acquisitions that we see where we now have Comcast, NBC, Universal, Time Warner, whatever, like the huge number of corporations
Absolutely.
That existed that were big corporations just 15 years ago that are now amalgamated under one roof. You know, so we definitely see that that's the case. I mean, the question about monopolies and free markets is a really fun one to turn on the right, because there was just the recent decision by the U.S. Patent Office not to enforce the Redskins patent on their name, given that it is a racist term and that therefore prohibits the government from ensuring that patent. And the right wing went bonkers, and they said, get your government hands off of my patents and stuff like that, and all that kind of stuff, when actually, what is a patent but a government-granted monopoly? Government says, you are the only person, you Redskins Corporation, who can benefit from this trademark. And what the government was doing in this case was taking a free market approach. It was removing itself from picking winners and losers in the marketplace. It was saying anybody can make money off of the Redskins brand, not just the monopoly owner that we have designated before. And yet the right wing didn't say, this is a great day for the free market. This is a great day for free exchange. This is a great day for the government getting out of the free market, removing itself from putting pressure on the economy and picking winners and losers. No. What the right wing said was, this is the government picking winners and losers. They're taking it out on the Redskins. They're being, you know, PC police and all this kind of stuff. And it really laid bare the sincerity of the claim that they make to wanting a free market. Actually, I think on the right wing, you'll more frequently find that it's not actually about free exchange. It's actually about preserving dominance, preserving hierarchy, preserving institutions.
Yeah.
And I think that really is a big motivating force on the right wing, much more than free market concerns.
Well, I got to ask Jesse Morrison a couple of things here. One, patents. You know, if I were to invent something, why not? I mean, I should reap the rewards of that, should I not? I mean, maybe a patent should be in effect for X number of years or something. I don't know. I mean, isn't there?
I think that's right. I mean, that's what the framers said, was that you, in order to foster the useful arts and sciences, you would offer a brief patent where briefly, specifically the inventor of the idea would be the sole monopoly owner of that idea, and then it would go into the public domain after just a little while. What we have now is a situation where not only are patents forever, I mean, they're like two lifetimes worth, effectively interminable
forever,
patents.
Yeah.
But then companies can get patents on every new update to it, and sometimes this means medicines. Sometimes when we're talking about medical patents, we're talking about the difference between saving millions of lives with cheap generic antiretroviral therapies available
yes.
for AIDS patients in
yes.
southern,
yes.
Especially in sub-Saharan Africa, but also elsewhere in the world, and preserving the patent so that a pharmaceutical company, not the inventor, not the person who came up with the science, because usually the science is performed with public research grants at public universities, but no, the corporation that owns, that takes that patent and owns it in its portfolio, we're talking about them making millions and billions of dollars, becoming one of the most profitable industries in the history of profits and industries by denying those drugs to people. And so it really isn't setting up a situation where inventors are rewarded. It's setting up a situation where patent trolls are rewarded, where people aren't, how did somebody put it? I think it was Susan Crawford, who's a law professor at in New York. She said that people aren't patenting inventions, they're inventing patents. And so you have a situation where people simply accumulate a portfolio of patents, not things that they have invented, but patents that they've bought from other people, they've bought out inventors, and then they go around suing people and making tons and tons and tons of money. And it's not because they're inventors who should be rewarded, it's because they are capital owners, and a patent is capital. So I think you're right that an inventor should be, or a creator of a creative work should be granted a brief monopoly so that they can make money off of that work, and then it should go into the public domain, and they should take the money that they got from that previous invention and put it towards the next invention. That is a really good incentive structure.
And it does seem to me the concept of public utility is a good one. When something is so pervasive, like, you know, the internet, like, I mean, things like Google and stuff like that, where it is absolutely a public utility, shouldn't it have some control by the public? I mean, come on, people, you know, it's just, it's something that we need. Like, water is a public utility that's regulated. Gas, you know, natural gas, electricity, these are public utilities. Isn't it time to apply these things? And this is not communist we're talking about. I found it interesting when I was in the New Hampshire State Senate, to municipalize ownership of what was then a private water company was the initiative of conservative Republicans, because they actually cared about the public good.
There's no question about it that municipal ownership of all sorts of those kinds of public utilities is a really, really good option that is exercised, not just, you know, as you mentioned, sometimes in red states, sometimes in far right-wing communities. But the other thing is that the biggest public monopoly, this, or public utility, the thing that we're told we cannot live without, and so we have to bail out companies, otherwise the whole thing will collapse, is the world of finance. And finance, if we really are as dependent on it as they say, you know, preserving Wall Street, preserving the stock market, preserving the big financial firms, preserving the financial law that we have, if that's really as essential as they say it is, then it really should be publicly controlled and regulated, like, like, you know, waterworks, gasworks, that sort of public utility. So I think that the main utility, the main industry that needs to be treated like a utility now that is not, is finance. And I think that would solve an awful lot of the problems that we have seen over the last 30 years and that resulted in such calamity in 2008.
And doesn't there, I mean, there's no pure capitalism. There's no pure communism. There's a mixture. I mean, I tend to see, you know, capitalism where it can work, the free market where it can work, and back it up with people having what they need to survive. If they don't have what they need to survive, that is not exactly a picture of freedom. And, you know, as I see people driving on down here near Boston, Route 128, every day, hours and hours in this traffic jam, to go to jobs that they oftentimes hate. Is that freedom? I don't know. We got to do better than that. I don't know if you have any brief comments on that.
No, I think that's totally right. I mean, I think that a brief glimpse around the sort of little boxes made of ticky-tack in society that has come out of late capitalism in the United States really does not show the sort of, like, flourishing, dynamic human freedom and diversity that we are told capitalism naturally fosters. I think it does not foster that. Capitalism, I write in the piece, capitalism imposes a double uniformity on society because it has tons and tons of people doing exactly the same work and tons of people, therefore, consuming exactly the same products. When you have these massive corporations doing the producing and employing, that is a necessary result of it. And that simply isn't the sort of that doesn't jibe with the picture that we are supposed to have of capitalism, of as fostering diversity, uniqueness, individuality, individual realization of individual passion. It really is a broken promise, I would say.
Well, thank you so much. I hope listeners have found this informative. I certainly has. You can follow Jesse Meyerson on Salon, writes a bunch of articles for that. Thank you so much for being with us today. I found it most informative.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
All right. And here's Billy Bragg.
Stand up, all victims of oppression, for the tyrants fear your might. Don't cling so hard to your possessions, for you have nothing if you have no rights. Let racist ignorance be ended, for respect makes the empires fall. Freedom is merely privilege extended. and build walls to divide us. Walls of hatred, nor walls of stone. Come greet the dawn and stand beside us. We'll live together or we'll die alone. In our world poisoned by exploitation, no sooner taken, they must give. And then the vanity of nations, we hope one earth on which to live.
Begins the final drama in the streets and in the